It is Friday, the 12th day of February, and this is VOA's International Edition. My name's Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. Coming your way in the next half hour, world powers agree on a cessation of hostilities in Syria. The Pakistan military is making a major claim.
Al-Qaeda has not been completely destroyed, but it has been diminished.
We'll hear more about that, and you'll hear a physicist trying to help us understand a major scientific proof of a discovery made a century ago by Albert Einstein. Yes, it's more confusing than that, and it's all ahead. Our top story on International Edition, the continuing talks aimed at somehow, some way to bring peace to Syria. Diplomats did agree today to work toward a temporary cessation of hostility in Syria's civil war within a week, although efforts to secure a lasting ceasefire fell short. The deal appeared to be the result of a compromise between the United States, which had wanted an immediate ceasefire, and Russia, which had proposed one to start on March 1st. Joining us from the site of the talks in Munich is VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. Pam, what's meant by a temporary cessation of hostilities as opposed to a ceasefire?
Yes, the cessation of hostilities language is very interesting. And what Secretary Kerry said is the reason why they're using that language is because using the term ceasefire has more legal teeth. It's interesting because, as you may recall, in the lead-up to this, one of the sticking points for the opposition was that they wanted a ceasefire. They were especially seeking relief from the Russian-backed Syrian strikes over Aleppo that had led to a humanitarian crisis. Now, interestingly enough, Secretary Kerry came out today. He was heading into a bilateral meeting with China's foreign minister, and he said to reporters he wanted to clarify something. And he said what they got last night with the International Syria Support Group with the cessation of hostilities represented what the opposition wanted. In his words, he said the opposition called it and defined it as a cessation of hostilities. So a clarification from him. Of course, all of this will be interesting in how it plays out over the next days, whether or not there is a full agreement on the terms of this cessation.
There is some exclusion from this cessation of hostilities dealing with terrorist groups. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. The cessation, as it was explained by Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov, does not include terrorist groups. So this would, of course, not include groups such as the Islamic State. But one interesting point that Foreign Minister Lavrov made, he said that around the besieged city of Aleppo, terrorist groups were operating. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out going forward. It almost appeared that he left a little wiggle room for continued airstrikes.
Does this agreement, or what seems to be an agreement, set a date? The United States wanted an immediate ceasefire, and the Russians were saying, okay, ceasefire, but wait until March 1st. Is there a date set on this thing?
This is something that they hope to implement within the next week. Of course, the next few days will be telling in terms of how much of it can be put in place. Another interesting factor is that the United States and Russia, in particular Foreign Minister Lavrov and U.S. Secretary Kerry, are going to be chairing a task force that's going to look at a broader plan for implementing some type of cessation that would last for a longer period of time and have more lasting results in Syria.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins in Munich covering the continuing talks aimed at coming to some kind of peace in Syria. Pam, thanks for being with us as always. This is International Edition from the Voice of America. As you know, if you listen to this program, we always want you to know what's trending as far as social media is concerned, so you can see if you agree or disagree with the rest of the world and how that makes you feel. Personally, I like to disagree with the rest of the world most of the time. But to accomplish that role, we again welcome International Edition's media guru, Andrew Palcheski. And Andrew has a name that I would like to, that he wants me to ask him about.
Yes, and actually,
Kanye West, right?
And Taylor Swift.
And Taylor Swift. That's what you told me, and I forgot.
Now, anytime you have Kanye West and Taylor Swift, of course, it's going to be a big social media moment. Case in point, the MTV Video Music Awards, when Kanye stormed the stage and said that Beyonce was the greatest of all time, stole Taylor Swift's moment. Well, years later, years later, here we are. Kanye West has released a new album, Life of Pablo, which is trending on social media. But in one of the songs on this album, he says, and I'm condensing here for language, basically, I made Taylor Swift famous, referring to that moment at the Video Music Awards.
It's a good thing he has no ego, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, of course, this has set off a social media firestorm. Of course, now Taylor Swift has a huge social media fan base. They are all now attacking Kanye West, saying, you didn't make Taylor Swift famous. She was famous on her own. You stole this moment from her. And then Kanye West comes out with a Twitter rant, which is about as long, if not longer, than the 17-track album that he just released, going off, starting with, I did not diss Taylor Swift, and I've never dissed her, and going on from there, a series of tweets saying that actually Taylor Swift gave her blessing for this and suggested the idea and thought it would be funny for him to include this. Well, now Taylor Swift's people are striking back on social media saying, she actually thinks it's misogynistic. She never supported this. So you have this war between the Taylor Swift fans, Taylor Swift's people, Kanye West fans, and Kanye's people back and forth on social media.
And the only thing that this does is to make people talk about them and say, ooh, I like that music. Let me download that.
How curiously timed.
Isn't that amazing?
How curiously timed this is to come out with Kanye's album at the same time his album is being released as this Twitter fight going on. All I have to say about this is I'm very glad it's a Friday.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Palcheski, looking at social media. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Did you hear that? That's the sound of a gravitational wave generated some 1.3 billion years ago by a pair of black holes that had smashed into each other in a cataclysmic explosion. David Reitze, executive director of the LIGO Laboratory at Caltech.
We have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
Some 100 years after Albert Einstein predicted their existence in his general theory of relativity, scientists announced that they were able to observe ripples in the fabric of space-time. Back on September 14th, the Twin Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory detectors located in Louisiana and Washington State picked up the gravitational waves in the final milliseconds of the merger of two black holes to produce a single, more massive spinning black hole. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You might have heard these words uttered here in Washington yesterday by Dr. David Reitze, executive director of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
Well, for the first time, scientists have observed ripples in the fabric of space-time called gravitational waves arriving at the Earth from a cataclysmic event in the distant universe a long, long time ago. It also confirms a major prediction of Albert Einstein's 1915 general theory of relativity and opens an unprecedented new window onto the cosmos. Joining us on International Edition is Dr. Leo Singer. He is a member of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. Dr. Singer, I think I just like to say that, but it's also LIGO. For those of us who are trying to figure out what this all means, can you offer an explanation?
Well, let's see. We're looking for ripples in space-time, which are caused when you take a lot of mass and get it moving really, really quickly. And so the best way to do this is to take two stars, but not ordinary stars. They have to be black holes or neutron stars, and put them in orbit around each other and then smash them together. And what that does is it creates these ripples that travel billions of light years to the Earth, and then we try to detect them by watching, by timing how long it takes light to make a round trip in our laser detectors.
So what does this mean for the future? What does this mean as far as future either exploration or understanding of the universe? What does it mean?
Well, I think the most exciting thing is it's a whole new way to study the universe. We have telescopes that study the universe in visible light, in radio waves, in X-rays, in gamma rays. And every time we've built a new type of telescope, we've discovered new types of events and new types of explosive transients. And what's most exciting about LIGO is that it enables us to look at very different sorts of events. It allows us to, instead of look at the universe, sort of hear it. The other exciting thing is that we have some of the, we've sort of seen the most direct observation of black holes. We've actually seen these two black holes in spiral and merge. And I think it's just fascinating to connect with such exotic and sort of out there astrophysical situations.
It was back in 1915 that Albert Einstein predicted all of this. And that was many, many years ago, like more than 100 years ago. How was he able to figure that out without the equipment that you guys used to prove it?
Well, Albert Einstein initially thought that gravitational waves were potentially real, and then went back and forth several times thinking that they were not, or that they were, and that they would be so weak that they would never be detectable. And with the technology of at the time, there was no chance of looking for gravitational waves. But what's changed over the past 100 years is that we've built different types of precision measurement technologies, culminating in the advanced LIGO detectors that are able to sense extremely small changes in length. And I think that it's just a testament to how far technology has come.
Just opening up a whole new chapter in science and investigation. Dr. Leo Singer is a member of LIGO, and he joins us from Maryland. And Dr. Singer, thanks so much for being with us here on International Edition.
Thank you, Ira.
You will all be tested on all of this later. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. Major story coming out, or at least what seems to be a major story, coming out of Pakistan today, that officials there are saying that they have dismantled al-Qaeda's main network in South Asia and foiled plans to break out of jail a man involved in the murder of journalist Daniel Pearl. We welcome to International Edition from Islamabad, VOA's Aisha Tanzim. Aisha, what's this all about?
Pakistan has an ongoing military operation to clear out the militant hideouts in its northern tribal areas, which were very restive, where U.S. And other countries often said that militants were hiding, not just militants from Al-Qaeda, but also militants from local groups, including the Pakistani Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, amongst others. And so the military, when it launched the operation, gathered a lot of intel from that too. Now, and as it launched the operation, it also launched intel-based operations around the country, as well as a separate operation in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, which had seen a serious deterioration in law and order. So a paramilitary force is there trying to clear out that city.
Does this question the claim that was made then that this is really going to put a dent in the entire Al-Qaeda network all through South Asia or just in Pakistan?
The biggest strength of Al-Qaeda's regional network was in Pakistan and Afghanistan. As we know, you know, Osama bin Laden was killed in near Islamabad in Abbottabad. Al-Qaeda's leadership is still supposed to be somewhere in either Afghanistan or Pakistan. We don't know exactly where they are. So if Pakistan has arrested 97 militants and have dismantled their infrastructure, that would be considered a serious blow to Al-Qaeda in South Asia, because they don't have as strong a presence in other countries like India or, you know, other countries in South Asia. Afghanistan and Pakistan is where they are. So, yes, it will be considered a serious blow.
Well, obviously it remains to be seen as far as future attacks are concerned, either in Pakistan or all through South Asia, as to just how effective this has been. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, Al-Qaeda has not been completely destroyed, but it has been diminished in the region, and that's U.S. Intel assessments as well as Pakistani intel assessments. So this remains to be seen how much else, I mean, what kind of infrastructure or other things Al-Qaeda has. But one thing a lot of people agree on is that as far as Al-Qaeda and Pakistani Taliban are concerned, Pakistan has shown seriousness in going after them, in arresting them, in dismantling their infrastructure, in making sure that their operational capability is disabled.
This is International Edition. That was Aisha Tanzim on a major story coming out of Pakistan. Time to look at business now. U.S. stocks open higher this day, led by a rebound in energy and financial stocks after a steep sell-off throughout the week. Watching what had been a roller coaster ride, mostly downhill so far this year, is International Edition's Jill Melandrino in New York. Jill, things opened strong. Have they remained that way?
Yeah, the market certainly opened strong, and we saw a continuation of that in the morning session. And like you said, it was led by energy and the financial stocks, which have taken quite a beating. In fact, the S&P 500 is down nearly 10% for the year. And of course, energy and financial stocks are a big component of the index. And I really think that's why we're continuing to see a lot of volatility in the markets, because quite honestly, the oil supply glut has not been fixed yet. We saw a little bit of a bid this morning, meaning that oil moved higher because there were reports overnight that OPEC may potentially discuss production cuts. This is a rumor that we hear time and time again.
Well, any reports coming in today? We're running a little short on time. And anything that meant anything?
The only thing that we saw was on the overnight. The Wall Street Journal had reported on Thursday night that we potentially could see production cuts out of OPEC. As far as what's happening in the financial sector, I think a lot of that there is what we call a dead cat bounce, or bouncing from the lows, because the sector has been so beaten up. The fact of the matter remains is the global economy growth is slowing, and there's a lot of uncertainty around central bank policy right now.
Jill, I thank you so much. Every week at this time, tune in and listen to Jill Melandrino in New York about what is happening as far as the U.S. and world stock markets are concerned. Well, it's time for our music segment. This one deals with Adele, and for that, we bring in VOA's David Byrd. All about it.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering.
Adele's song Hello, off her latest album 25, is one of the top-selling songs of all time. Adele's fans around the world have responded with recordings of their own versions of Hello. In music, this is called a cover.
Hello, it's me.
Lydia Lee is a high school student from South Korea. Her simple video cover of Hello in English has collected over 17 million views on YouTube. A singer named Sarah receives 5 million views with her cover of Hello in French.
Hello. C'est moi.
In Kenya, a singer named Della has posted a version of Hello in Swahili. The song has about 500,000 streams.
Hello.
The most watched cover of Hello on YouTube, though, is from Leroy Sanchez. He's a musician from the Basque region of Spain. His cover has over 25 million streams.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all.
Karen Rodriguez in Miami works in a hotel, but she has dreams of a singing career. She competed in American Idol, a show for aspiring singers to get noticed. Rodriguez made a video of herself singing Hello in English and Spanish. This week, her Spanish version has more than 8.5 million views on YouTube. She thinks the song going viral will help her find an audience for her music. Word-for-word remakes of songs are allowed, but song translations and adaptations do not have the same freedom. So if you're making a video of yourself singing Hello in other languages, you might owe some money. I'm Rebecca Ward.
Thank you so much for being with us. That's our show. Have a good weekend. I'm Ira Melman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States joins the international community in expressing zero tolerance for female genital mutilation, cutting. This practice, said President Barack Obama, harms and holds back entire communities. It has no place in any community and undermines efforts to empower women and girls. At least 200 million women and girls alive today have undergone female genital mutilation. The latest figures from UNICEF show that nearly 70 million more girls than previously thought have been subject to this barbaric practice. Female genital mutilation cutting includes all procedures that involve the partial or total removal of external female genitalia or injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. There is no excuse for such blatant human rights violations of women and girls. As President Obama said, just because this is a tradition in some places does not make it right. This practice is harmful and therefore wrong wherever it occurs. That's why the U.S. has funded programming to combat female genital mutilation and cutting in places like Guinea. At home, the United States has criminalized the transport of girls to undergo female genital mutilation, worked with religious leaders and community-based organizations to raise awareness, especially in some immigrant communities where the pressures to engage in this practice remain, and provided grant opportunities for domestic, non-governmental organizations implementing innovative prevention strategies. The United States stands with communities at home and around the globe working to prevent female genital mutilation and cutting. We call on girls and their families, teachers, health workers, community and religious leaders, and government officials to act together to make a difference, said President Obama. It's time to put an end to this harmful practice and to allow communities everywhere to meet their full potential by enabling women and girls to meet theirs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.